Welcome to Fright School. Are you ready? Class is in session. Welcome back to Fright School. Hello, Joe.
What's up, Joshua?
Doing so well.
Yeah.
The day is going well, you know. We're living, we're alive, we're here,
we're living, we're laughing, we're loving.
Yeah, exactly. Eating and praying, all of those things. I saw Fortune Feimster last night, the comedian. It was delightful. Mm-hmm. She's really funny. And her opening act, I can't remember her name. I'm going to have to look it up, but she was really funny too. You actually might recognize her. But it was a joyful evening of laughter for the most part.
Wonderful. All the particulates swirling about you.
Right, exactly. No, we all had, the particulates are there, totally. But everybody had to wear masks the whole time indoors because we're California. So we know that. Go ahead.
I was going to say, I just need to know who the opener was because I might actually know. Oh, see, I'm on Fortune's website. That's what the sound was. So professional.
Yeah, I don't know.
You had good seats too.
I had great seats, or a seat. I had one great seat. Although then it turned into I had lots of seats because the four people that had tickets next to me never showed up. So I had a lot of space to myself, and it was at the Balboa where there's this sort of weird. So they have like row 1, 2, 3, whatever, but it starts with like AA and BB. So mm-hmm. I was in BB, which is basically the second row from the stage.
I didn't know you were a BB girl.
There we go. Exactly.
And maybe an AA girl, but maybe some BB.
Right. what are we talking about? I don't know. But anyway, so my chair kind of jutted out just a little bit. And then there's like a wall that separates that section, like the pit, from the rest of the seating. So I kind of had like this little bubble out of myself. That was really great. So although we were indoors and all of that, I kind of had like plenty of space to just be in my own bubble because like nobody was next to me. And you know,
you must have looked extra like a rock star, like all these seats you just purchased for yourself.
It definitely felt like that. And I dressed up, you know, I was looking good. Some girl ran over to me and was like, "I love your aesthetic." I was like, "Thank you. Have a good night."
Was it pretty sold or?
I saw that. So there were two showings. There was like a 7 o'clock and a 9 o'clock or whatever, 9:30, 7:30. And the 7:30 was like real. It was packed. Like that was all sold out from what I saw on like Ticketmaster. But the showing I went to, I mean, it was full. Like it was definitely full. And the audience had some drinks and they were like off the chain. Fortune even came out. I mean, who knows? Maybe she does this at every show, but she came out with her cell phone. She's like, "Okay, I'm recording tonight because you all sound really fun." From like backstage, you know. So mm-hmm. she like, and the opener said the same thing. She was like, "You all are wild, like you are on." And it was definitely true. Like, and there were two guys sitting behind me that clearly thought they were just at home watching Netflix, so they were like yelling and talking through the whole thing. And I also think that they had seen the show already, so they knew there were jokes coming up, so they kind of kept spoiling the show a little bit, you know, which was annoying. Yelling out like the punchlines before like Fortune got to them. That was super annoying, but I just kind of blocked them out. I was like, you know what? I'm not going to start a fight with these assholes behind me. I'm just going to focus on the show. We're all going to get through this together. And then like towards the end of the show, they just vanished. So I don't know what happened to them. Maybe somebody came up to them and was like, "Y'all got to go." Maybe somebody complained, but for the most part, it was really, really fun. Really funny. I laughed a lot. I hope she films it and puts it out soon because it was enjoyable.
Awesome. Good to hear.
Did you do anything fun this weekend, this past weekend?
No. last weekend I finished Cobra Kai. We didn't really get to talk about I was like, I really want to talk about that now. I finished Cobra Kai. I finished You. I'm caught up on Netflix's You.
Yeah, Dexter Lite.
I don't know if it's Dexter Lite.
I'm kidding. I have never watched it.
But it's,
that's what people compare it to, is Dexter.
No, it's very Dexter. I think it's Dexter for it's this generation's Dexter. You know, once in an age, is a man.
There we go. Once in an age.
a man reveals himself to be. I think that this is, it's such a fascinating show. Because it's also like a study of people, and this season, the third season, they are in like San Francisco, like in the Bay Area. So it's a lot of talking about like the weird, crunchy granola, techie people that live up there.
Ah, okay.
Which I was like, oh, I kind of enjoy this. I don't know. This is not a show that I recommend unless you've already started seeing it. But if you do ever watch it, Joshua, please let me know, because I would love to talk to somebody about it.
Well, there we go. I can't remember. Did we talk about the tragedy of Macbeth?
No.
Yeah, okay. Sorry. You know, again, what did we say inside the insider? What do you always say? This might be a little too...
Inside baseball? Insidery?
That's what I think. Inside baseball. That's why it didn't come immediately to mind.
I was like... I mean, I don't even know what that means in the literal context. I know what it means in the metaphorical context.
Right. But still, regardless, either. But like...
Well, yeah, talk about it, Joshua. Talk how much you want to play Lady too, M.
That's not where I was going to go. What I was going to say is that because our recordings over the last couple of weeks have been a little... we're playing with time a lot more than we have, I think, in the past. So I'm like trying to remember what we talked about that's for an episode coming out later that we already recorded.
Yes.
But anyways, the point is that no, because we recorded that episode before I watched the film. I do remember that. So we watched The Tragedy of Macbeth. That's the short story in this already jumbled mess. With Denzel Washington and Frances McDormand, directed by Joel Coen. Although, actually, we should also say starring Catherine Hunter. She's, like, top billing, I think. No, but kind of. She was amazing. She's the woman who plays, like, the witches.
I actually watched it, too.
Oh, you did? Okay. Yeah. Oh, yay, look at that. We're, like, on the same page.
I was like, I think I should watch... I think I owe it to, like, my, you know, pretentious high school, early college self to watch something Shakespearean, so...
Now, see, that's so funny that you bring up the pretentious thing, because I sent a message to, like, my little friend group chat that you're
I was going to say to your pretentious friends.
No, because I sent a message saying this might, I mean, I don't know, this might be an interesting conversation to have with you maybe quickly here, especially because we, you know, obviously I shouldn't say we, I read you for not reading, and like, you know, sometimes I think maybe I insult you sometimes, and I, you know, out of love, but
you read me for not reading?
I read you for not reading, but I had sent a message to our friend group because I was like, Sam Scrunch and I just finished The Tragedy of Macbeth. I thought it was really great. I thought that Catherine Hunter was amazing. You know, Denzel's like portrayal of Macbeth really restrained and, you know, really built through the film rather than kind of, you know, Macbeth is a weird character that people, some guys like play him, or some people, I should say, some people play him like really intense, like from the get go, and he just kind of stays one note. Some people, you know, keep him really low. I just think Denzel did a good balancing of that. Frances, of course, was amazing as Lady Macbeth. It really felt like, I know that they're both classically trained. So of course, like when she was speaking, it felt like she understood what she was saying, which I think is really, paramount to like really good Shakespearean actors, is that it sounds like they're using the language as if it is a language. They're not just saying words, you know, they get the meaning of what they're saying. So I just thought it was really great. Send it to the group. Like, hey, you know, check this out. If I put the caveat, I was like, if you like Shakespearean language and like plays, I think you might enjoy this. So it kind of started this conversation with the group about that kind of concept. Like, you know, what does it mean to like understand Shakespeare? Like, mm-hmm. is this something that we should like value as like a signifier of like, well, you said like pretentious, you know, which it can be very pretentious. Like, oh, you don't understand Shakespeare. You know, it's like one of those things. And so one of my friends was asking if this would be a good thing for like a noob to Shakespeare. And I really didn't know how to answer exactly, because I'm like, I consider Shakespeare, this is kind of how I put it, like a genre of music. Like, you either like it or you don't. You know, like, you either are like, oh, this beautiful classical aria or symphonic piece, I love it, it moves me. I kind of think Shakespeare is in that same sort of category. Mm-hmm. You know, it's like, it's a poetry, it's a certain way of speaking, it's a certain structure. But I don't put any value on, like, knowing it as if, like, you're smart. To some extent. Like, I don't think people are, like, you know, should be like shamed if they don't like Shakespeare. I feel like it's a kind of music.
Yeah, my experience with some people that we know is that there's a fetishizing of Shakespeare.
Yeah.
That to me really rubs me the wrong way, because it's like, you know, it wasn't great back then, right? I was like, you know, it wasn't like great back then. Again, because one thing that modern theater has going for it is that there are more people who are included in terms of their perspective and life story and all that stuff. And I mean, again, Shakespeare wrote also for, I believe my understanding is that Shakespeare wrote for like the common person. He spoke the part, he spoke in the vernacular, he invented his own words. He was kind of, you know, if I was like a cool English teacher in the inner city, quote unquote, teaching Shakespeare, that's how I would teach it. Right. Mm-hmm. But I feel like I don't get people who are just like, oh, Shakespeare. And I'm like, no, it's like you said, it's a genre of music. Sometimes it's really good and it really hits. And I do appreciate, the varying interpretations of it.
Yeah.
But yeah, I mean, I don't know. I think like for beginners, I mean, I'm kind of, I'm kind of spoiled, because like my introduction to Shakespeare was King Lear in ninth grade. My English teacher, she was like, I'm supposed to teach you all Romeo and Juliet, but I fucking hate Romeo and Juliet, so I'm going to teach you King Lear. And I was like, yes, badass. And so that was what kind of got me interested in it, because I do love the idea of, deciphering meaning and the wordplay and all that stuff. And I think that's one thing when like watching Shakespeare is difficult, because I do like to know the backstory of certain things, like what is it? I think it's in Much Ado About Nothing. There's a line that one of the women has about, like, you know, something being a jade's trick, and then like a jade is also a type of horse, but it's like a commentary on a woman, and like, you know, all that stuff. Those are the things that I like, and one of the reasons why I like reading Shakespeare. But again, reading Shakespeare is different from seeing Shakespeare played out, and I think people understand it better when, if they haven't read it, if it's just like a show.
Yeah. Maybe. I kind of feel, but like the one of the things that I liked is with the Apple TV, like, because that's where, you know, you can watch Tragedy of Macbeth, one of the captions kind of put the dialogue in like iambic pentameter.
Nice.
Which I watch everything with captions anyways. You know, I've said that before. But especially like a Shakespearean piece, I like to be able to read it as it goes. So I do find that very helpful. And I love that they kind of structured it, you know, like the verse in a way. I mean, yeah. It was also interrupted with like musical cues and, you know, sound cues and such. But
I definitely had to watch it with the subtitles as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I really liked how they did it, where it looked like the, you know, the way it's written. I thought was really cool. But yeah, so what did you think of the film then overall, like after seeing it?
No, you're correct. You're correct in what you said about Denzel. Like, he I forget that he can play these really intense characters. I think like I think that we're starting to lump Denzel in the like vein of a Sidney Poitier. Like in thinking of like he's our like now our elder statesman black actor. And I forget that like, you know, this was also the guy who was in who's in Training Day and played like this really, really cool villain. Yeah. You know, I think he got an Oscar. I think he got an Oscar for Training Day. I forget if that's his Oscar.
I'm not sure. You're our resident Academy Awards
I know, and I fucking hate that because like the Golden Globes were, and I'm like, yeah, I mean, I could care less.
I know. It's definitely changed. It's like, who cares? I don't care.
Yeah, I don't care as much because the thing is, though, is that like the Golden Globes are like completely rigged. So it's like, who cares about the Golden Globes? I mean, all manner of like that. I think award shows give off the artifice that there's an object that this piece of art is objectively the best when there's no such thing as objectivity, right? So if we are starting to believe that like there's no such thing as objectivity, bias pervades everything, then there's no wonder that like hashtag Oscar's so white,
right? You know,
but again, not true. All of that to say is that I enjoyed, I completely picked up on what you said about Frances McDormand, like, and her and Denzel, like, they believed what they were saying.
Right.
You could really feel it. I just can't help but also think, like, what if we got an Angela Bassett, you know, reprising her role as Lady Macbeth? Mm. I think that would have been something really, because she's also just really good at being, like, she's good at being the histrionic, sinister aspect of it. Yeah. Whereas like Frances McDormand and Denzel, it was restrained, but like it was meant to be, they knew that they were going to show this on a smaller screen. And that's what it felt like. There was an intimacy about the entire production. Mm-hmm. It gave very much, Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Yeah, German Expressionism, I think it was a major, major influence.
Yeah. And some points it was like at some points it was like the Seven Wonders reenactments in American Horror Story.
Yeah. Which I think are also meant to kind of look like those old 20s films. Yeah.
Exactly. Because it felt very much like that. It's like if you gave someone with all of that production and but other than that, it was like, it was beautiful. I hope it gets nominated for stuff because I think, or at the very least adaptation.
I really liked it. I wish we had gone to see it in the theater because it did have a limited theatrical release, but it was like over the holidays, it was like just kind of a mess. And you know, with everything going on, it was just, there's no way to like go see it. So I'm hoping if it gets nominated, maybe it'll get another chance to in the theaters for like a couple weeks or something, because I would really like to see it again on the big screen.
But did you notice that it had like, it wasn't letterboxed in widescreen like it was?
No, and that was a choice. I watched the Apple TV had a like a 14 minute documentary or behind the scenes of the making of it, and yeah, they made a lot of choices with that. And I think you're right. I think part of it is that, you know, they knew it would be on like Apple TV. But I also think there were like just things they were trying to do stylistically. I don't want to say too much. I think people should watch it and then watch that themselves. Overall, I just thought it was very, very, I couldn't look away from it. It was just well composed, strange, also, I like that one of the things that they did talk about is I think that Macbeth and Lady Macbeth are usually portrayed like younger, or like they, in the play they're younger, but this was sort of like, I think that's why they're not as like, you know, like she's not like maniacal, you know, it's desperation, you know, they're older, they're played older, and as people who are like desperate to keep relevancy and keep, you know, it's like the last ditch effort to be king, you know, kind of thing. So it just gives it, I don't know, the whole production just has a different vibe than I've seen in Macbeth in the past. Not that I've watched, you know, the million productions of Macbeth that there are, but yeah.
What would you say, since you've maybe have thought about it a little bit, are your like top two picks for like intro to Shakespeare adaptation film?
Man, I don't even know, because like, oh, well, that was what I was going to go back and say is like with my friends, because, you know, another friend commented about like they enjoy Shakespeare. It's fun. Sometimes people can make it really joyless. And I was like, well, Macbeth is a joyless show. Like, it's not. So maybe this isn't a good, like, I wouldn't say this is like the best thing to start with if you're, you know, wanting to get into Shakespeare, unless you like horror movies or thrillers, mm-hmm. you know, or like just kind of, it's depressing. I mean, there's no way around it. It's a very depressing show. Lots of death and lots of unjustified, you know, murder. And, you know, so I was like, it's pretty joyless. So I don't know. I mean, I guess if somebody was going to be like, what would be the first thing? There's like a film of Midsummer Night's Dream with is Michelle Pfeiffer, I think, is in it.
And yeah. Mm-hmm.
And
Kevin Kline and Rupert Everett. Like,
yeah.
It's like a who's who of the 90s.
Yeah, I think that'd be a fun one to do. And that's in the language, right? I can't remember. Mm-hmm. It's been so long since I watched that, I think, when I was in high school, maybe, or maybe in college, my first go around. So probably something like that. I also agree that I'm not a big fan of Romeo and Juliet, just as a play. I love that meme that goes around that it's like, it's a 3-day love story between some teenagers where like everybody dies. It's like, when you put down like what the actual plot of Romeo and Juliet is, I hate it. But I do really, I like the Baz Luhrmann film.
I think if you're going to get into it, like, it does a good, because it's also like, I mean, just like those teenagers, like, you know, hormones are so heightened at the time. I feel like that really translates to Baz Luhrmann's style. And
yeah,
I mean, yeah, I was going to mention that one, Baz Luhrmann's Romeo and Juliet. And then
it just seems so cliche to say that.
Yeah. If you want to like turn it up a little bit, or at least my favorite Shakespearean adaptation on film right now is Much Ado About Nothing by Joss Whedon. That they filmed like at his home when he was in between Avengers movies.
I know what you're talking about. I did not see that one, but I
also black and white,
and updated too. Right? Yeah. It's like,
I love it because it's like, he's like this scroll, and he's holding his BlackBerry, like, which is my favorite thing in any like Shakespearean adaptation. It's like when Leonardo DiCaprio buys the goes to the apothecary and gets the poison, and he's like, here's my gold, and holds up like a wad of cash. I'm like, yes.
Yeah, I think it does a good job translating that. Like, if I had like a, you know, a high school English class, and you're going to have to do Romeo and Juliet, I think that'd be a good way to like show it. You know, I also really like Titus with Anthony Hopkins, the Julie Taymor and Jessica Lange. I just love the style of that. I love the costuming of it. I don't know if it does anything to like help you understand Shakespeare any better, but it's fun to watch. It's bonkers. You know, it's just really, really bonkers.
Is Alan Cumming in that?
Yeah.
He's one of the sons, right?
Yeah. He's, oh shit. Who does he play? What's the name? I can't, you know, what's sad is I was actually just watching it. My brain is,
you were just watching Titus?
Yeah, because I realized I wanted to like just see Jessica Lange in like some of the costumes again, because she's so beautiful. I mean, she's such a beautiful woman, and the way they do her, it's just really, really incredible. As the Queen of the Goths.
While you look up who he is, I recently also watched this documentary on HBO Max called Reopening Night, and it's about the public theater's reopening of Shakespeare in the Park in 2021 for the like opening to audiences for the first time since COVID, and given everything that happened with June Justice in 2020, they decided to pivot from what they originally planned to do to a completely different show. So they had a playwright come in and adapt Shakespeare's Merry Wives of Windsor, but it is adapted into the vernacular of the like African diaspora communities of Harlem. So it's like, two wives and they're like, you know, African, like Nigerian, like talking to each other. And it's the whole, because it's a comedy. So it's fun, but it was also super celebratory. I really hope that they somewhere, because they showed a lot of the production and all the challenges that they had with it. But like, I really want to see that show somewhere, because it just looked like, it just looked amazing the way that they were able to adapt it and play that off for people. So, you know, they used the Shakespearean text, but they also incorporated like incorporated aspects of every character represented a different African country, a different African culture, and the styles were, it was just so beautiful to look at. I really hope that they have that production up somewhere soon.
Yeah. I'd like to see that. Alan Cumming plays Saturninus, the crowned emperor of Rome. So not his son, but he takes Tamora, that's Jessica Lange's character, as a wife. And then she's queen of Rome, and then she can take her revenge on Titus for his war crimes and other terrible things. Anyways. Point is, yeah, there's lots of great Shakespeare. I think, again, it's another one of those things where it just depends on your taste, you know, like there's probably a version of a Shakespeare play out there that, you know, appeals to everybody. You just, you know, gotta find it. But even if not, that's okay too. If you're like, no, fuck that guy, fuck Shakespeare, I don't want to listen to poetry when people are talking, that's fine too.
I mean,
or whatever we want to call
it. You don't know this about me, but somewhere in this room, I have a, I took a screen capture from the internet of one of the production photos from a Shakespeare in the Park of Twelfth Night that stars Audra McDonald, Raul Esparza, and Anne Hathaway.
Oh, fun.
And I took that because the photo itself is really beautiful and kind of captures what the whole play is about in one image. And I took it and I had it framed and I have it like as a little art piece, because I'm just like, this is just so brilliant. I remember being really, really taken with that. So we'll link it in the show notes. I'll find it.
That's another fun gender play, you know.
Yes.
Play.
Yes, we're all about playing with gender.
I know. I tell you, I'm going to make my realization happen. I put it out into the world and, you know, what you were saying with me, like that I had posted about wanting to play Lady Macbeth. I was like, somebody's got to do a gender swapped Macbeth so I can do it. Let's make it happen, Joe. Well, yes. Fright School presents.
Fright School presents. Can you imagine?
Alrighty. Well, I think that's a good place to wrap up this portion of the show. And then we will be right back to talk, I guess, about the
Hey everybody, I'm Chris Fafalius, and I'm the producer of Krista Makes a Podcast and the host of the One Hit Thunder podcast.
And I'm Matt Kelly, host of Horror Movie Night and the producer slash the head of content for the Geekscape Podcasting Network.
Between the two of us, we have, believe it or not, 25 years of podcasting experience, and we want to help you start your own podcast.
We know podcasting, and we want to share that knowledge with you.
So whether you're new to podcasting or you want some feedback on your currently active podcast, we want to help.
Or perhaps you're just overwhelmed with all of the editing work. Well, we can help you with that also.
You can check out our website at weknowpodcasting.com for more information.
We're excited to help your podcasting dreams become a reality.
All right. Welcome back, Joe. This week, we are wrapping up the original Scream trilogy in our January 2022 franchise deep dive. We're starting a new tradition by dedicating January to one franchise. This time it is 2000. Oh my gosh, let's go back to that, which was 22 years ago. Oh my gosh.
Holy moly.
Scream 3. directed by Wes Craven, written this time by Aaron Kruger. Kevin Williamson was just having so much successes, you know, doing all kinds of things, doing the Dawson's Creek, doing the Faculty, doing whatever other, everything he was writing. He was in demand and he was not available. But he had written, I think when he first sold Scream, he wrote treatments for 2 and 3, which 2 was largely that story. Minus some changes. They had to like change the killers, because of like script leaks and stuff. But that has nothing on the production of this film and the rather miserable, I think, time for everybody involved in some ways. Reflected really well in the making of the film within the film, where they're changing the script and everybody's kind of... I know that's supposed to be a comment on like Scream 2, but I think it's more of a comment on like Scream 3. They were metaing the time right there, you know?
They were metaing in real time.
Yeah. Anyways, we got our three back, you know, David Arquette, Nev Campbell, Courtney Cox. We got them. And then joining the cast, legendary Lance Henriksen, even more legendary Parker Posey. Just, I really think she's my favorite thing about this film. I don't know what movie she's in, but I wish that Scream 3 was that movie. Because she's just on a whole other level throughout the film. We also got Patrick Dempsey, Jenny McCarthy, you know, Dion Richmond. Fun. Yeah.
So, you're like not mentioning Emily Mortimer or Matt Mortimer, Kiesler.
There she is. Matt Kiesler. Yes. Scott Foley. Oh my gosh. I'm just going to run down the whole cast. Let me see who the stunt people were.
I mean, like, you named, it was like, and, you know, Lance Henriksen. I'm like, yeah, okay, I guess, because we're a horror podcast, we got to name Lance Henriksen. But, like, Emily Mortimer.
Happy to see him pop up. He's another person that I feel will never die. So whenever he does die, because he's looked the same since the 80s, since he did Pumpkinhead, I feel. Like, he just stays. He's a classic. I don't know what to say.
And he played a great character too. Like,
you know, problem is, I'm sorry, real quick, is that like all these people that you're talking about, I only know from this film. So like, whereas like Parker Posey, I've seen in a million other things. Lance Henriksen, I've obviously seen in a million other things. But I never watched Scrubs or Felicity or Scandal, so I don't know who Scott Foley is. I didn't know he had a career. I thought all these people's careers, outside of the already famous people's, ended with this movie.
Are you kidding me?
Who's Emily Mortimer? Has she done
Emily Mortimer?
Oh, I do recognize her now.
Yeah, she was in The Newsroom. She was in some other HBO show. She's been in things.
Yeah, she has been in things.
I was like, I was completely gagged. I think I texted you. I was like, Emily Mortimer, Matt Kiesler.
I know, yeah. Well, that's one of those things, though, because you do that a lot where you send, again, I mean, you know, hey, like, newsflash, my pop culture really is limited to, like, horror shit. Like, you know, I don't watch I'm not like Matt Kelly. Like, I don't know how that guy, he knows everything. You know, he watches everything. I'm not like him. I'm like, horror it is all the time, 24/7. So, like, I just didn't, yeah, you're sending me names. I'm like, I knew you'd be excited about these. That's why I compared you to Alanda, the YouTuber I'm now in love with and want to have over here and be my friend. I know she's done other things, but that's, you know, right. I'm getting to know her through her YouTube responses and reactions, because she does the same thing. Oh, I didn't know Gossip Girl was in this. I didn't know, you know, Grey's Anatomy doctor was in this. And I'm like, I don't know who these people are. I didn't watch this.
I'm telling you, Matt Kiesler was like young Joe. Loved him some, like, you know, Matt Kiesler bit part role. He's in Sour Grapes with Steven Weber, which is like the most asinine comedy of the late 90s, early 2000s. Matt Kiesler was also in The Middleman. If Matt Kelly is listening to this and he remembers anything I've just said, I need a text right away.
I did recognize him from Waiting for Guffman, which I do wonder if he and Parker Posey shared any, like, you know, moment on the set. Like, remember making that crazy movie? But yeah, other than that, like, I'm looking through his like list of films. Scream 3. Yep, I know that. Oh, he wasn't an episode of Masters of Horror. So, I mean, he's done some things that I've seen, I guess, but I don't remember. No, Not much though. Numbers. Oh no, that's the wrong thing. That's a show, not a movie. Yeah, and that was back in 2006. So yeah, sorry. I'm really. Yeah,
he doesn't get like he's one of those leading guys of the late 90s who kind of look the same. You know, it's like Matt Kiesler and Matthew Modine and one of the there's like twins from Seventh Heaven.
Brothers.
Yeah, like they're all you know, like if Ryan it's Murphy like was making
Pine
shit
and Chris Pratt and Chris whatever there.
Well, no, it's
are.
Like Matt Bomer kind of looks like Finn Wittrock. Oh, they all right. kind of look the same. Like that's kind of what.
Yeah, Cheyenne Jackson.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's true.
You're seeing that meme of all the faces looking at you.
I like am.
That.
Yeah. 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 Or the one somebody shared it where it's like Margot Robbie, Jamie Presley. It's
oh, like, no. I'm convinced they're all the same.
Yeah. There's like 10 women. It's like none of these are the same person. I'm like, yeah, I know. But then
that girl from The Babysitter.
Right.
She yeah. also looks like Margot Robbie, Jamie Presley.
Yeah. Yeah. Anyways, this is not the point of the show to talk about how all white people look the same. The point, well, white famous people all look the same. Surprise, surprise. The point is to discuss Scream 3. But that's the thing is, we kind of did this deep dive and then I'm like, man, what are we really going to talk about with Scream 3? So, Joe, let's start with your thoughts on how you felt about the trilogy coming to a conclusion with this film back in 2000.
It was wild.
Yeah. Say the least.
It was like knowing that it went through so many rewrites and there wasn't like a cohesive, you know, things were happening so much behind the scenes. It makes me a little more forgiving of the film.
I agree.
I think 3 is like my least favorite right now. I did love everything with Cotton though. In the beginning, I was like, oh my God, he like hosts some sort of Jerry Springer program and he died.
Right. 100% Cotton. LOL. Hashtag.
Yeah. everything with Cotton was great. I was like, oh my God. Like, so this, you know, also at the same time, he's like, you know, hey, what are you wearing? But don't touch my girlfriend. I'm like, wow, what a dirtbag.
Man, right. You know, so many things, you know, like just compartmentalizing there really well. Yeah, I love that. I love that, you know, we know it's a horror film because like Creed starts playing right away, right at the beginning.
Horror film of the 90s.
Right, yes, they were making that then. Creed must have been, I did not look into this, but I'm imagining they must have written a song for it or something because there's a Creed poster in Sydney's, like, fake room, you know, for the set. So yeah, I'm guessing Creed had something to do with the soundtrack. But yeah, when like one of the first songs in the film is Creed, I'm like, oh Lord, this is not boding well. I also like that the person is like recognizing Cotton's voice.
Mm-hmm.
But I'm like, Cotton also to me sounds like Ted Levine or Levine from Silence of the Lambs in a way. So
yes.
I don't know. If he picked up the phone, I don't know if I would immediately, you know, I might not know it's his voice. I might think he's like, you know.
He's like, your voice sounds familiar. Are you Buffalo Bill?
Yeah, you are Buffalo. this is Buffalo Bill. I know you.
That, yeah. Are you one of the henchmen in Flubber? That's you, right?
Well, that's even better. Sorry, I interrupted you, though. So go on with your thoughts on Scream 3.
That's pretty much it. That was...
This one again, right? You're going to watch this one every night.
I'll watch everything with Cotton again. It was so, like, everything in the beginning with Cotton and then everything at the end in the house. That's all I cared about, where everything in the middle kind of meshes together. The Jenny McCarthy of it all, like, could care less. I did love, like, her. I think she's, like, talking about that she's basically Tatum, right? Like, she was, like, arguing with Scott Foley on the phone. Like, I'm basically the Tatum.
Yeah.
of.
Yeah, she's like, I don't know what my character is. Like, what am I doing? Which again, I mean, it is trying to be, you know, commentary. Like, that's kind of what Scream does, like doing the meta, you know, like these movies are all the same. Like, what's going on? Why are we making this? What's the point?
And I got to say that, like, this movie, like Scream in general, but like I think Scream in general just like never met a Deus Ex Machina that it like didn't like, right? And and for those, you know, for those who didn't take like AP English or haven't read anything, I'm saying this and I haven't read anything.
This should be great.
Deus Ex Machina is this convention in a literary convention and theater convention where like literally something happens that like saves everybody or changes everything. And it comes from the Greek theater where a god would come down, god from the machine, Deus Ex Machina, would come down and like basically say everything, it was a dream. It's like when you say it's all a dream,
right?
Or this
just
didn't
a way to like get
wrap it all
out
up.
Of a corner. Yeah,
exactly. Like it's that thing, and it may not necessarily make any narrative sense, but it just kind of happens. And so like with Scream, it's like it never met a Deus Ex Machina that it didn't like I think like Billy Loomis's mother in at the end of Scream 2, that to me I'm like, what? This woman. Which it makes sense, because if they change the killers because of leaks, then that would make sense, because they don't hit at that at all. her being the killer, which I mentioned last week when we talked about it. But with this, it was just like Randy, you know, wheeling Randy out from the grave, and like Heather, and then like, you know, have Heather Matarazzo come out and being like Randy's cousin, Randy's sister. She's, you know, he wanted you to find this, and I'm like, oh my gosh.
Yeah, that's very shoehorned. I think there was an idea at some point that he was going to be alive, like he somehow survived the last film and was like in hiding or something. I don't know. I was, you know, reading all these different production notes and watching. I watched a couple of YouTube videos about sort of the production of this, and you know, so that was an idea, and then that didn't work. But they still like the studio. Because, you know, to really contextualize this film, it came out like right, you know, after like the Columbine massacre, you know, so you have this like in that time in 2000, I remember there was a really, even I feel like even more so than now, obviously, like kind of not since the 80s, like blaming of like violence in the real world on horror, on video games, like what's going on with our children? What are we allowing them to watch? So I think the studio had a real like fear of putting out like this violent, like there was a point where they didn't want any blood in the film at all. Like all deaths had to be like off screen or somehow there couldn't be, like they didn't want any gore. And Wes Craven was like, fuck out of here. What? Like, we're either making a horror picture, we're making a Scream movie, or we're not making a Scream movie. Like there's no, you know, other, you know, although I do think that when you watch the film, although there are deaths in it, they're not as, there are a few deaths that are after the fact, you know, like you just see people covered in blood rather than, you know, I mean, there are stabbings in it, obviously, you know, not to say there aren't, but I do feel it's a little, it's very heavy on comedy. You know, it's very, it's much more funny than the others, and just downplays, I think, some of the gore to some extent. I think there were compromises made.
Well, which is interesting because again, the film is not like, the film doesn't take place at a high school. There aren't teenagers killing each other. There's no mass shooting. There's guns, but there's no mass shooting kind of thing in it. And like, cause you think about like when American Horror Story Cult was going on and they like took out that scene.
Right.
Like when Sandy Hook, right? Cause it was Sandy Hook.
Took out
that scene because of Sandy Hook.
It all, I mean, unfortunately it does mesh together because there's so many.
Yeah, but it's one of those things where it's like I think that if they were to remake it now, like if that movie was being made now, I think because we're so desensitized because of the ubiquity of mass shootings and everything, I think it will get to a point where, like, yeah, they would have just let it fly. I mean,
yeah, maybe if they were making them now, maybe we would have gotten a really different film. But you're right, they did. They pulled away from the teenage setting, kind of made everybody, you know, they've left Woodsboro. It's not in some tiny town. It's in Hollywood. And so there's this whole conversation going on. Mm-hmm. And obviously, I think very influenced by what happened at Columbine and sort of the state of the world. And, you know, having these conversations about, like, real life versus film, you know, and how it kind of informs, you know, because I'm almost all horror, you know, the stories that we tell have basis in reality, you know, the things that horrify, like the things that horrify us, the things that happen in our lives that, you know, are terrifying or are scary, we like translate into horror, I think. Not necessarily the other way around, but then again, there are plenty of cases where people are like, oh yeah, I binged watched, you know, Dexter for, you know, over and over and over again for 5 years and got an idea to like chop up my girlfriend. Like those are, you know, there are real cases out there of people claiming at least that they were influenced by watching a film. But
that Scream 2 defense.
Right. You know, but I also feel like, you know, well, and even in the original Scream where he's like, you know, horror films don't like create murders. They make or psychos, they make psychos more creative or whatever it is. Which I'm also like, yeah, I don't know if like just some, like I've watched, I mean, I don't even know how many hours of horror films and I never thought like, I'm going to go chop somebody up. Like there has to be other inciting, you know, factors or else, you know, the millions of people who enjoy horror any given year, there'd just be a lot more, you know, yeah, I don't know. It's more like, what is that? The Ouroboros? It's
kind Ouroboros, of
like
a, yes.
Eating its tail kind of thing. Like, I'm not, it, like, chicken and egg. Like, I don't know if we can place the blame on either. But I like having the conversation. I like studying it. I like analyzing horror through that lens, the cultural anxiety of it all. You know, what we do here on a weekly basis as best we can. Yeah. So again, it's like, yeah, who's responsible for like the horror of the world?
Mm-hmm.
And this film, I think, is trying to have that conversation, and that's what I will give it.
Well, so
to some degree,
I think what this film is saying is that the person who's ultimately responsible for the horror of this film world is Sydney's mother, and how much of a hoe she was.
Well, yeah, I was going to get to that because that is the other problem. There's a lot of like victim blaming in this. And yeah, nobody like it's like, well, sure, whatever. You can say whatever you want, like as her daughter, that like you're hurt by her actions or whatever. But it's not okay that she gets like murdered for it. Like that's, you know, that's completely wrong. Like, you know, divorce, fine, whatever, you know, you have to deal with the ramifications of your family's feelings about like the actions you might take. You know, again, it happens all the time. Like, you know, where are those, where are like the men, all these horror films where men get like butchered for doing that and then shamed after, you know, for mm-hmm. like doing the very same thing. But you know, that's not the function of most horror.
and she was also like, you know, again, Sydney's mom was a young actress who was put into positions that, you know, she was Harvey Weinstein'd.
Like, that is something I was going to talk about that I think we get with the benefit of time. And rewatching this movie, I've definitely seen this the least amount, which again, because our next episode, I guess I should maybe just caveat, because our next episode was recorded already, I think we made a comment about Parker Posey's character that's not true, but I also forgot because I've definitely seen this movie the least, and it's like every time I watch it, it's like everything immediately leaves my brain because I'm just like, what is this movie trying to do? But rewatching it again for this.
So you're proactively correcting yourself.
I know, because it'll probably come up. So I'm just going to pre-warn that. Yeah, I think we're like, we don't know what happens to her. And it's like, no, we do know what happens to her. Now I do remember, but it is really quickly in the film. But not the point. The point is watching it again this time and being like, okay, I've got to watch this, pay attention to it, and like think about the film in the construct of Fright School. When I first saw the Weinstein, you know, name on it, you know, that immediately I just was like, oh God, you know, their name is still on like every fucking thing. And then as the film progressed, I'm like, oh my gosh, this is like another instance of like men telling on themselves with, because they know they don't have any, like these powerful types of men, there's no consequences. Like, and I was reading, I did find an article about it and how like nobody complained about this like movie mogul casting couch situation. Mm-mm. You know, his whole like speech about like, well, yeah, you know, we had parties and like things happened to the girls and like, you know, too bad. It basically, like, that's what happens when you come out here. You know, you got to play the game or go home. You know, what else? Nothing happened to her that she didn't invite in one way or another, no matter what mm-hmm. she said afterwards. So they like put this out, you know, years before the, you know, the Me Too movement, everything would break. Although I think allegations surrounding Weinstein probably were out there, just again, like ignored or, mm-hmm. you know, hidden. But yeah, I guess they, I'm trying to see here. Yeah, they disagreed because they wanted to make Emily Mortimer's character the other killer. Like, there still would have been two killers. Mm-hmm. They didn't like that, but they were totally fine with, like, Big Shot, producer, and predator has his throat slit in his own lavish home screening room. No studio or executive notes for that. Maybe because, again, like, they had to, you know, they would have had to maybe admit to some things. Like, no, that's totally fine because it's totally unbelievable. Like, none of us here would ever do such thing as have a casting couch. What is that? I don't even know what it is. You know, so it's like, yeah, it really recontextualized the whole film when you're like, oh my gosh, this is like a Me Too story. 16 years before, like, that would all explode.
Yeah.
For something, again, that, like, you know, the saddest part about, like, the Me Too conversation is that everybody's like, well, yeah, everybody knew. It's just, what are you going to do about it? And then you have films like this where it's like, yeah, we know. We're well aware. We're so yeah. aware of it that, like.
What is it we say, Joshua? We already been new.
But yeah. Here, you know, here it is in this film. Like, and again, he's, like, at the root of it. Like, his. Even like less than like how they blame Marine, like he's like the father, the long lost father of Roman and, you know, child, or, you know, Roman is the long lost child of Marine Prescott and Milton, which also very Paradise Lost, you know, like what's going on there? Maybe there's more to like pick at in that whole conversation as well. But that might be a comment on like Hollywood as a whole, yeah. like, you know, the nine circles of hell and all this kind of shit. Very Dante's Inferno. Mm-hmm.
I did not see the Roman reveal coming, though. I was Emily yeah. Mortimer all the way to the end. Which, again, like, I love about these films is just, like, you really can't put it past. And again, because they're also playing with established conventions, even fans of the films, something that looks completely telegraphed, they know to distrust it. So it's like, it's almost like there really is no, you have no indication of who right. may or may not be the killer. What bothers me and what bothered me with this film is like, oh, we assume he's the killer, surprise, but then his whole backstory is revealed in the reveal.
Right.
So
much like Billy's mother.
Exactly. Much like Billy's yeah. mother. And I'm just like, I guess, I mean, this is me as a verbal processor, you know, saying these things out loud and processing it in real time. So it's like, yeah, I wish there was a little bit of foreshadowing. but at the or like, you know, in the, like I said last week, in the case of Get Out, where it's like, you know, there is foreshadowing, but it's like just slyly built in there that you have to
subliminal kind
of. It's subliminal. Like I wish that was there a little bit more, a more dexterous hand at that. But at the same time, like if we're experiencing it also from like Sydney's point of view, she's getting all of that exposition right then and there too.
Right.
So we get it the same time that she does. Instead of like being, you know, omniscient because it's a movie, right? We're getting it all from her perspective.
Yeah. It is bizarre. Again, and using that like another like estranged kind of family member thing. But it's also something like that the Saw franchise does that I don't mind, you know, because each Saw film, like they go back and you find out some kind of insane connection that, you know, is like three or four removed from whatever the main action is. And it just, you know, gets more and bigger and bigger. And you have this like huge web of like who's all involved. And, you know, so there's always this rewriting of the story in a way as it builds. And so we get this added and then it's like, okay, so now Roman is the one who like showed Billy Loomis the evidence of Marines, you know, so it does add this other layer to like the story of like how the information, I guess, got out. I don't know if we needed that, but
like what would it have cost? I mean, again, more dexterous hand, hindsight's 2020. What would it have cost to put in there a like flashback scene of like a Billy Loomis at a motel being presented documents,
right?
That like an unseen figure, you know what I mean? Like that is the kind of stuff where I'm like, oh, that's interesting. You bring back Skeet, you know, Ulrich.
Yeah.
I don't know. I mean, again, least favorite of the franchise, but still fun.
Yeah, I mean, again, it's not one that I don't pleasure watch this. Like, it's just because there are other problems. But
I totally. I'm so glad you said. I thought you were going to say I don't pleasure myself to watch this, but
no. I don't just put this on is what I mean, just for fun. You know, this may have been the last time I will see it. I don't know. We'll see. But, you know, I just
reveal.
What?
That was a reveal. Like, that's a pronouncement.
It's just not a movie like I would go out of my way to watch, you know, and I don't even like think like, you know, when I rewatch Scream, like I don't then think like, this is all because of Roman. You know what I mean? Like, I just feel like I block out. Like, I do. I feel like I just kind of have a block on this movie. Outside, again, of, like, Parker Posey. She's just super fun. She's, like, so at an 11 the whole time. You know, her smoking that cigarette, the way her hands, like, flared out. Like, I'm smoking. Someone's going to pay for this. I'm just like, I don't know. I just love her. She's just so strange. And... again, you know, watching Alanda's YouTube video, the second Gail came on screen, she was just like, what did they do to her? Like, what happened to her head? And I can't, that's the other thing. It's so painful to me. Like, I feel so much for Courtney Cox. Like, Gail has no gay friends. It's clear. Like, she pissed them all off and they didn't come to help her, you know, with her hair.
No, they did not.
So I just... it's just, yeah, I don't know. And maybe it's like, that is so superficial, but there is just like, I'm like, what the hell happened? Like, your bangs. So terrible. There's no educational value in that. I will say that I love when Parker's character, Jennifer, like accosts Gail and like decides like, I'm gonna hang out with you because people are trying to kill you and maybe they won't kill me if I'm with you because they want to kill you and they'll kill you instead of me. Like that whole thing. And then they go and hang out with Carrie Fisher. I love that whole sequence as well. I love Carrie Fisher's character in this. There's a lot of nice little cameos because it's like Hollywood. You know, you get what's their names, Kevin Smith, and you know, you get Jay and Silent Bob. And, you know, there are all these little like just kind of, you know, nudge nudge, wink wink moments, and I really like Carrie Fisher's character in it. I don't know. I just miss her a lot, and so maybe I would watch this again and just fast forward to the parts that I like. Parker Posey jumping into the arms of the bodyguard, Carrie Fisher, like, you know, well, I'll tell you who got the part, the one who did sleep with George Lucas. Like, that's, it's just delightful. Like, this whole commentary on Star Wars in a way. And the whole thing, again, when the big reveal with Milton, it just, I don't know, there's just these little moments that do tie in now that we have that to look back on, like knowing what the Weinsteins were up to. But even at the time, like watching it, like again, like it's so accepted. Like it's so like, oh yeah, casting couch, this, that, whatever. Yeah, that's what you have to do to get ahead in Hollywood. That's not a new thing because of the Me Too movement. But I just think it reclassifies this film in a way in watching it. I don't really have any other, we kind of hit on it. I will be curious to see once, you know, we're going to do Scream 4 next week, and then, we'll have Scream 5 to break down as well. And I can't wait to see what your final list is of like how you'd rank the films. I'm kind of excited for that. I'm curious with your new eyes, what you think are the best Scream. What's the best Scream movie and what's the worst? So be cooking on that, Joe, because I'm going to ask. I wrote mine down already.
I bet we've already talked about it.
Yeah.
I bet this is the episode where we talk about it. One of those.
But after you see Scream 5, you have to... then we'll talk about it then. And I think we're going to have another guest on for that show. So I'm curious what their list will be. We'll all compare. Maybe it'll be the same. Maybe it'll be different. I don't know.
Yeah.
Any other odd thoughts besides the usual stray observations?
Let's be done with it. I mentioned that when you said that you may not watch this again, like that really struck me because I feel like rewatching, like a joyful rewatch is your brand, but it was not joyful to rewatch this. So therefore, you know.
Yeah, again, like, it has its moments, but overall, I also think like because it was, you know, I real quick, I do try to like forgive like all the production issues, yes, but it's like, I think that they really thought there were going to be two killers for most of the film. So like Ghostface is like every fucking where. And because we live here, like we know what it's like in Los Angeles to get anywhere, you know, and that killer, even back then, even 20 years ago, still like he is just popping up everywhere. Like, is he helicoptering in places and then like getting back out? Because that's the other problem with the film that I have on rewatching it. It's like, man, like he's killing a lot of people really fast and like really, I feel small amounts of time. It feels that way. It feels like there should be two killers.
I thought Patrick Dempsey was the second killer.
Oh.
So like,
he does get a little weird.
He gets like really weird. And then like, and then at the end, it's like, come on, Sid. And I'm like, what? Also, like, don't leave your door open. Like, is it really over? Like, don't leave your door open, Sydney. At the very end, where she just kind of like leaves it. And I'm like, I'm just going to leave it. Like, we'll see what happens. Don't leave the door open.
Yeah. Anyways. All right. Well, that was Scream 3. So we thought it was over. But guess what? A decade later, 11 years later, Scream 4 rears its head. We'll be talking about that next week. Yeah. So we'll see you then. Good night, Joe.
Good night, Joshua. Fright School is produced by Joshua Napier and Joe Farron.
Our intro was edited by Davey Boy Productions.
Our logo was designed by Jamie Channel Guzman.
Episodes are edited and engineered by Joe Farron.
Fright School is produced in terrifyingly beautiful San Diego, California.